This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is a clear and completely unjustified departure from the commitment that many of these countries made at the meeting of the G20 countries in Rome last month.
That's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on travel bans imposed on Southern African nations because of the new COVID-19 variant. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopia has denied its state an attack over the weekend along its shared border with Sudan. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa is urging countries to urgently end discriminatory and unscientific travel bans on Southern African nations because of the new COVID-19 variant. Last Thursday, South African scientists revealed they detected a new, potentially more infectious variant now known as Omicron. A number of countries, including the United States and United Kingdom, responded by prohibiting travel to and from Southern African destinations. They say the restrictions are necessary to delay the spread of Omicron in their countries and to give their health experts time to prepare for possible outbreaks. Darren Taylor has more.
In a televised address to South Africans, Ramaphosa called the travel bans deeply disappointing.
This is a clear and completely unjustified departure from the commitment that many of these countries made at the meeting of the G20 countries in Rome last month.
He said the G20 nations, including the US and UK, had pledged to follow the guidelines of the World Health Organization, the WHO, with regard to international travel during the pandemic. The WHO has classified Omicron a variant of concern, indicating it may be more infectious, cause severe disease, and lower the effectiveness of vaccines. But it's opposed to travel bans as a strategy against Omicron or other variants. Ramaphosa said G20 leaders also resolved to support the recovery of tourism sectors in developing countries.
These restrictions are completely unjustified and unfairly discriminate against our country and our Southern African sister countries. The prohibition of travel is not informed by science, nor will it be effective in preventing the spread of this variant. The only thing the prohibition on travel will do is to further damage the economies of the affected countries and undermine their ability to respond to and also to recover from the pandemic.
Medical experts say more highly transmissible and potentially deadlier COVID-19 variants will continue to emerge as long as Africa remains largely unvaccinated. Most people in developed countries have been immunized. The WHO says only 7% of Africans have received a dose of vaccine.
Why do you take so long to vaccinate people around the world? You're going to have more virus circulating. You're going to have more variants emerging.
Fatima Hassans, a lawyer for the Johannesburg-based Health Justice Initiative. Since the beginning of the pandemic, she's spearheaded African efforts to get equal access to vaccines. But pharmaceutical firms have hung on to their intellectual property, or IP rights, to the jabs, maintaining control of production and global supplies, and allowing them to sell vaccines to countries with more money. Hassan echoes many scientists when she says this situation, more than anything else, is responsible for the emergence of the potentially more infectious Omicron variant.
Instead of having that kind of commitment to trying to get vaccines as fast as possible to at least 40% of people in parts of the world, particularly Africa, what we're seeing is a really racist knee-jerk reaction with the imposition of widespread travel bans, and that's simply unacceptable to us.
She points out that Omicron has been found in several European nations, but they aren't banning one another, and the US is also not stopping flights to and from those developed nations. The lawyer reiterates that vaccines are the only way to slow the spread of COVID-19.
It's simply not okay and sufficient for pharmaceutical companies who have hoarded knowledge and hoarded supplies and prioritized northern customers to say, well, we'll only deliver to you in February, March 2022. It's wrong to say to Africa that you don't matter. You must wait, and you must wait longer. And while you wait, we will ban all your travel, we will cripple your economies, and we will shut down your industries.
Hassan, along with more than 100 low-income countries, says waiving big pharma's IP rights to the jabs will end the pandemic by allowing vaccines to be made and distributed across the globe. But several European countries, including the UK and Germany, and others like Australia, Canada, and Japan, are blocking the proposal to the World Trade Organization. In the US, the Biden administration said in May it would support negotiations around the waiver, but hasn't gone any further than this. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Dilapidated and dangerous so-called hijacked buildings, abandoned properties taken over by slumlords, have eroded the value and security of downtown Johannesburg, South Africa's largest city. But one local charity is reclaiming and restoring a historic building to provide shelter to those in need. For VOA, Linda Giftosh and Zahir Kasim visited Hillbrow and have this story from Johannesburg.
It may be crumbling at the seams, but hundreds of people call Florence House home. The former maternity hospital in Hillbrow, Johannesburg, was built in the 1950s and later transformed into social housing in the early 2000s. In the past 5 years, though, the trust that owned and managed the building disbanded, leaving a void of responsibility. Juma Sabichwa is the founder of Malaika Orphanage, which is based on the second floor of Florence House. He says he's witnessed decay because of neglect and a gap in management.
So people around, they started just to manage themselves. Yes, you see the mess there where people dumping those rubbish. Because there is no proper management. If someone is throwing garbage there, yes, they don't have someone to restrict them that this you cannot do.
The phenomenon of hijacked buildings stems back to an exodus of property owners when the apartheid ended. Criminals often take their place, demanding rent from tenants without providing any upkeep. The problem is exacerbated by a housing crisis. The city has reported that over 450,000 people are registered as in need of homes, meaning tenants in hijacked buildings have no alternative. Tulani Nkosi is a senior attorney at the Socioeconomic Rights Institute, a nonprofit organization advocating for human rights. He says authorities must act to make lasting changes.
The solution is for this local authority to get involved, actually take over the building itself as the municipality, maintain the building, and then make sure that it subsidizes. Because at the end of the day, you know, the duty to house people, the duty to accommodate people rests with the municipality.
Officials have vowed to tackle the issue. Last year, the city reported that over 1,100 instances of what are known as problem properties were investigated, but only 16% of hijacking cases were resolved. Two university students have decided to take matters into their own hands after seeing the appalling conditions while delivering food parcels to the orphanage. They established the cooperative, The People SA, to clean up Florence House. Sky Burgess is the co-founder of The People SA. She explains what prompted the students to start the initiative.
I feel that if everyone keeps on arguing on whose responsibility it is, the job actually never gets done. If it's dirty and you're complaining that it's dirty, just pick up a spade and clean it. You know, you might as well.
They've removed tons of trash, and they're in the process of waterproofing the roof and repairing hydrants. Josh de Villiers, the co-founder of The People SA, says they don't, however, intend for their work to be a permanent solution.
Our goal is to make this livable and to ensure that the building can survive until the state or anybody decides what to do with this building. So our goal is to do the structural work that is on all those areas that are damaged.
Keeping the building standing will prevent tenants from facing homelessness. But whether a cleanup and repairs will be enough to save Florence House in the long run remains to be seen. Linda Giftosh for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Sudan's military reinstated Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok last week and promised to release all political detainees after weeks of deadly unrest triggered by a coup. under an agreement signed with military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, Hamdok will lead a civilian government of technocrats for a transitional period. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi prospects for the agreement to lead to a real democratic transition.
The prospects in Sudan under this agreement are not promising. The deal between Burhan and Hamdok was not a reinstatement of the civilian-led government that Hamdok was leading previously. Rather, it is a restructured government that military will have a heavy influence over, with Hamdok essentially serving as a figurehead. And it's notable that despite being in the agreement, many of the political prisoners that were detained following the October 25th coup remain imprisoned. And in fact, there are more arrests happening every day. And so the latest agreement does not portend well for the hoped for return to a democratic transition in Sudan.
The Forces of Freedom and Change, FFC, the civilian coalition that shared power with the military before the coup, said it didn't recognize any agreement with the military. Could that hinder Hamdok's mission to restore the democratic transition, which he described as his first priority?
Absolutely, this is important. The agreement from 2019 reflected a coalition of stakeholders from the civilian side and military. And Hamdok was identified as a representative for the civilian stakeholders. As such, you know, it was an institutional agreement. The agreement from November 21st of this year is an agreement between two individuals, Hamdok and General Burhan. And so it doesn't carry the same weight. It doesn't bring along the various partners and key actors that are going to be needed to form a government, to sustain a democratic transition, or to maintain stability in Sudan.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok said he will review appointments and dismissals made by the military to key state posts. He also said that an investigation has been launched into violations committed against protesters. What do you make of that?
It isn't clear just how much leeway Hamdok will have for these investigations. And by agreeing to lead a cabinet that will largely be influenced by the military, it seems that he will be beholden to the agenda set by the military. As part of the agreement between Hamdok and Burhan, there was a stipulation that all political prisoners should be released, but that hasn't happened. Likewise, there is a point in there that there should be investigations into the killings of, you know, more than 40 protesters that have been on the streets following the October 25th coup. But, you know, it's clear the military has very little incentive to support those sorts of investigations. And we have seen, even from 2019, when other protesters were killed by the military, that there's been very little progress made in conducting those investigations. So while I believe Hamdok is genuinely interested in realizing some accountability for these abuses, it just isn't clear how much authority or power he'll have to make that happen.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Ethiopia denied it carried out an attack over the weekend along its shared border with Sudan. Sudan says six of its soldiers were killed. Ethiopian government spokesman Legesse Tulu dismissed the claims as groundless. Instead, according to Reuters, Legesse blamed the violence on the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, the insurgent group that has been locked in a brutal year-long war against Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government. The spokesman also said the TPLF was training in Sudan and receiving support from unspecified foreign attackers. The border between Ethiopia and Sudan, known as Al-Fashka, has for years been cultivated by Ethiopian farmers, though Sudan claims it falls within its territory. In November 2020, around the time Abiy sent troops into Tigray to oust the TPLF, Khartoum stationed forces in Al-Fashqa, a move Ethiopia has described as an invasion. The situation soon escalated as the Sudanese army drove out Ethiopian farmers and militias from the area. At least 84 Sudanese troops were killed in clashes with Ethiopian soldiers and militias from November of last year till August, according to the military. The two nations have held talks, most recently in Khartoum last December, but have not made progress in resolving their issues. The Democratic Republic of Congo and neighboring Uganda have agreed to cooperate in hunting rebels in the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF. The Ugandan government blames the ADF for a series of recent bombings in the eastern part of the country. While many in the DRC welcome help in fighting the ADF, which has staged scores of attacks in the country over the years, there are some Congolese who are concerned. They are remembering that Uganda and Rwandan forces fought a bloody battle in the DRC city of Kisangani in 2000, in the middle of the DRC's 1998-2003 civil war. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti is in Goma in the eastern DRC. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pondawson about the situation.
According to some political actor, it's a good idea, and all MP of North Kivu, for them it's a good idea, because Congolese army don't succeed to make end of ADF. But for the people, locals of Ituri and North Kivu, it's not a good idea, because Uganda has a rust pass in this country. As you know, Rwandan troops and Ugandan troops fighted in Kisangani in six open days, and that made more than 1,000 dead. And for that, some people are not accepting that idea. And Uganda said they will not come themselves. They need the support of AU or East African region support to get inside DRC to hunt up ADF.
Now, the fighting, the six-day conflict, tell us a little bit about that.
It was when Rwanda and Uganda was supporting the Eastern Rebellion of RCD, and it was about mining in Kisangani. They found someone with a big quantity of diamond, and there was a clash between officers from Rwanda and from Uganda, because officers from Uganda liked to take all the mineral, and officers from Rwanda liked also to take the mineral.
With the Kampala government cracking down on the ADF in Uganda, is there any hope that will help control the ADF in Congo?
The Ugandan spokesperson of government said that they found that fighters, terrorists, are leaving Somalia, Eritrea, Kenya, passing by Uganda to reach DRC. That's why Uganda was attacked. And after attack, the government said many of other terrorists involved in those attacks flee into DRC. That's why they would like to follow them in DRC.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in the eastern DRC. He was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pondawson. A recent report by the Christian Humanitarian and Development Organization World Vision says child marriages will likely increase as the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic continue to be felt around the globe. From Harare, reporter Kuzai Zanwashi takes a look at child marriage in Zimbabwe.
Nyasha Kurebwa, the advocacy and safeguarding coordinator with World Vision in Zimbabwe, is alarmed by the rise in number of child marriages worldwide.
If you see in the report, we acknowledge statistics from the 2021 UNICEF report, which suggests that given the impact of COVID-19 on hunger and education, there is a likelihood to have 110 million girls becoming child brides by 2030. And we work with UNICEF and we acknowledge their research and statistics.
World Vision's website says, in the last nationwide survey, 1 in 3 young women in Zimbabwe are married before the age of 18. The organization attributes the phenomenon in part to cultural and religious beliefs. For example, the government says that over 45% of girls who belong to apostolic churches are forced to marry. But COVID-19 threatens to make the problem worse. Observers say the pandemic has led to an increase in unemployment and decreased incomes. It has prompted the closing of some schools. In some cases, poor families have chosen to continue the education of their sons but have kept their daughters at home, and in many cases, offered their girls as child brides to alleviate poverty. World Vision surveys also show that boys tend to report more encouragement for school from their parents and caregivers than girls, a sign of gender inequality. The organization says a lack of help for girls with schoolwork and support for continuing their studies can sometimes be counteracted by teachers, but not when COVID leads to school closures. Nyasha Kurebwa says that there are efforts to fight child marriages by government and child-focused organizations. She describes some of the work underway by World Vision to improve conditions for girls that could discourage early marriage.
We are also working with the grassroots structures like the child care workers to respond also to these issues at community level. There are also awareness raising campaigns that are also happening. There are also successful engagements with traditional leaders and faith leaders to ensure that we also strengthen gatekeeping in terms of child protection within communities.
World Vision encourages national and local leaders to provide access to vocational training for girls, reproductive health care, and the elimination of policies that prevent girls and young mothers from continuing their schooling. World Vision's latest report emphasizes that ending child marriages would protect children from violence, contribute to improved child health, and reduce maternal and child mortality. The study also encourages policymakers to include children as allies in stopping early marriages in their communities and to address other contributing factors, including poverty, hunger, harmful traditional practices, and gender inequality. Childcare advocates are also pressing for a firm and powerful solution on the national level, encouraging Parliament to strengthen existing legislation, discouraging child marriages, or enacting an outright ban. Those debates are now underway. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehye Suhi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.